Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. In this episode, we're going to look at a recent unsigned opinion issued by the court in a case called Tharp v. Sellers, and then we'll talk about the four cases being argued in the second week of the court's January oral arguments. The remainder of this episode consists of audio from a Counting to Five YouTube live stream, which aired on Thursday, January 11th. Please stick around at the end of the episode for more about upcoming live stream broadcasts. And now, the January 11th live stream.
Hello, I'm Mike, the host of the Counting to Five Supreme Court podcast, and this is our second weekly YouTube live stream. We're planning, at least for the time being, to make this a regular weekly show. We'll be previewing upcoming oral arguments, reviewing opinions, talking about important Supreme Court news, and occasionally doing a deep dive into individual cases. If you are watching this live, please feel free to ask questions in the YouTube live chat at any time. And I'll try and keep an eye on that and try and address your questions as I go along. Be aware there's a little bit of a lag between before I see the questions, so you may have to wait a little bit for me to get to it. But I'll try and periodically take a look at the live chat and answer questions that get submitted by live viewers. And here's the agenda for today's live stream. First, I'm going to give some updates on the what the court's been up to just in the past week. And then I'm going to take a very quick look at a few of the oral arguments that happened earlier this week. These are the cases that I previewed in last week's live stream. And I'll just talk a little bit about some interesting things that happened at the arguments. And then main course, I guess, for today's live stream is a preview of the oral arguments that are coming up next week. They're coming up on Tuesday and Wednesday next week, and I will go through those cases and kind of break them down and talk about what they're all about. So let's get into it. First, a little bit about what happened this week. If you watched last week's episode, you may remember that I noted that the Supreme Court had only issued one single opinion in an argued case so far to this point in the term, which is very it's unusually low. They usually have several opinions by this point, and in fact, they were on track to be the second slowest the slowest start to a term since 1868, when the second opinion of the term in an argued case didn't come down until January 11th. Well, the court, we were anticipating that the court would start getting some opinions out probably earlier this week, but the court has yet to issue any opinions. So they've actually passed that record. Now, this is possibly the slowest start to a Supreme Court term. I haven't seen an update on if there was any pre-1868, but one of the slowest terms ever. It seems like the opinions have to be coming soon, so hopefully next week we'll actually see some. I checked earlier today, and the court had not yet announced any opinion date, any expected opinions coming down next week. So we'll see. We'll see how long this goes before they start actually deciding some of the cases that were heard in the fall. One other thing I talked about last week was the court's caseload. They have a very low caseload right now. The total cases that they have agreed to hear so far and have scheduled, cases they've scheduled or cases they've agreed to hear but haven't yet been put on the official calendar, is only 52 cases, which is very low. Even in low years, we've had several very light caseload years. In recent years, they've been in the low 60s. Right now, we've got 52 cases, and basically, the month of April's argument calendar is basically open, and that's the last month of oral arguments for the term. And basically, January is the last chance for the court to grant new cases that will be ready in time for the April arguments rather than have to be held over till next year. So we were anticipating that the court maybe would start getting some cases granted to try and fill up that April calendar. But again, this week, no cases were granted, no new cases. Now, this Friday, tomorrow, that's January 12th, the court has another conference where they'll be considering a number of cases to possibly grant. So it would not at all be surprising if either Monday morning or late Friday afternoon, because when the court is trying to get things on the calendar like this, they like to not waste time and get by granting right away on Friday, it gets the briefing calendar, the briefing schedule rolling right away. So it would not be at all surprising if this late Friday, the court grants some cases to start filling up that April argument calendar, but you know, there's no telling until we get there. So it'll be interesting to see. Hopefully we'll get a few additional cases granted, if not this week, then next week. But again, no way to know until it happens. Now, I said there'd been no opinions this week in an argued case, but there was one per curiam opinion on Monday the 8th. The court issued a new per curiam opinion. So a per curiam opinion is an opinion that isn't signed by an authoring justice. It isn't an opinion by, you know, Chief Justice Roberts or Justice Ginsburg or one of the other justices. It's instead issued by the court as a body. And the court's typical practice, there's occasional exceptions, but it's very standard, is in argued cases, cases decided after full oral argument, the court issues signed opinions, and the justices all either sign on to a majority opinion or they write or sign on to a separate dissent or concurring opinion. But when the court issues a summary decision, that's a decision made without oral argument, it typically issues a per curiam opinion. And summary decisions are where when the court has a petition for certiorari, that's the formal petition asking the Supreme Court to take the case. And sometimes instead of granting the case and then setting it for oral argument to be eventually decided after full briefing, the court will grant the case and then immediately issue an opinion on that case at the same time that the case is granted, and that's known as a summary decision. And usually they're reversing or vacating the lower court decision, and a majority of the court at least have decided that the case is not worth their time hearing, but the lower court was wrong. Decidedly wrong and can just be overturned. And they do this on a somewhat regular basis. There's usually maybe half a dozen to a dozen of these per curiam summary decisions a year. Often the court uses it to kind of police the lower courts to try and keep them in line in areas where the Supreme Court might think that a particular lower court isn't properly applying Supreme Court precedents. So the court will just step in to try and get them back in line, basically. This week's case is kind of an interesting one, and it drew unlike many of the per curiam opinions are unanimous, not by any means all, but many are unanimous. This it was decidedly contentious. So the case is called Tharp v. Sellers. It's very procedurally complicated. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail unless there's specific questions from the viewers, but the basic facts are this. A man named Keith Tharp was charged with murdering his estranged wife's sister by shooting her with a shotgun in the course of kidnapping his wife. He was convicted and sentenced to death. Some years later, seven plus years later, after his conviction, Tharp's attorneys obtained an affidavit from one of the jurors who convicted him. And the affidavit basically contains a lot of flatly racist statements. Tharp, who is black, was characterized in the affidavit as not being the good type of black folks. The juror indicated because of that, choosing between life and death for Tharp just didn't really matter. It wasn't a big deal. He also went on to say something to the effect that he wondered if black people even have souls. So some very incendiary kind of statements that very clearly show, you know, a racial animus. He also claimed in the affidavit that some of the other jurors in deciding to convict and sentence Tharp had said that they wanted to send a message to black people that they couldn't get away with killing each other. So these are the statements that were made in this affidavit that was brought some years later, was brought forth some years later after the conviction. So Tharp brought a habeas corpus action on the basis of this affidavit, and I don't want to get into all the details of it, but eventually he gets to a point where he's seeking permission to appeal to a federal court of appeals. And in most cases in the federal district courts, if you lose, you automatically get to appeal to the courts of appeals. But in certain types of cases, including these habeas cases, you have to seek permission of the court of appeals. You get a certificate of appealability from the court of appeals that allows you to appeal. Now, the court of appeals denied that. So Tharp, what he's coming to the Supreme Court with is a appeal to the Supreme Court of the Circuit Court of Appeals' denial of his request for a certificate of appealability. So it's a little complicated, the procedural aspect of it. But basically what the Supreme Court did is the court held in this per curiam opinion that this affidavit at least debatably provided clear and convincing evidence that the juror's racial animus had a serious, you know, effect on the jury's verdict. And because of that, the court said that the grounds that the Court of Appeals decided on, the reasoning they decided on in denying the certificate of appealability was invalid reasoning. So they are sending the case back to the Court of Appeals kind of for a do-over. But they did not say that the Court of Appeals should necessarily issue a certificate of appealability because there are other issues out there, procedural issues that might prevent, his habeas, action from going forward. And so the Court of Appeals is going to get to consider those other issues that might bar him from going forward. So it's still an open question whether he'll be allowed to appeal and you know continue to bring this action or not. The opinion is very short. The majority, the per curiam opinion, is less than 3 pages long, but it is accompanied by a lengthy dissent, some 13 pages or so, by Justice Thomas, who's joined by Justices Alito and Gorsuch. And it's a pretty, aggressive, critique or attack on the per curiam majority. And he basically accuses the majority of bending the law because of these extreme statements in the affidavit that the court is unwilling to follow standard neutral principles of law, that it should be applying in every case, but is kind of twisting things because of how bad some of these statements in the affidavit are. But in the course of this opinion, he makes a number of other strong criticisms of the action by the majority. He argues that the court ignored inconvenient facts that were considered and were found very important by the lower court. And one is including the juror who signed this affidavit apparently only days later signed a second affidavit where he basically recanted the first and claimed he had been very drunk when he was approached by Tharp's lawyers. And also that, 11 of the 11 other jurors, every other juror on the jury panel denied that there was any consideration of Tharp's race in their deliberations, which contradicted the original affidavit. One of those jurors submitted, their own affidavit and the other 10 gave live testimony, contradicting the affidavit. Thomas goes on, he also argues that the court failed to properly give, deference to the decisions of the lower courts that are being reviewed here. And again, it's procedurally complicated, but the ultimate factual decision about whether, juror racial bias affected the decision is wrapped up in this case in several layers of procedural questions with different standards of review, some of which are very deferential, where a reviewing court is supposed to give a great deal of weight to the lower court's assessment of the facts. And he also argues that the Supreme Court misconstrued the ground on which the Court of Appeals opinion rested. And in order to avoid having to deal with some issues that the court didn't want to deal with. And he suggests that the court is being hypocritical. It's kind of pretending to take a strong stand against the effect of racial animus in a jury, but the way that they've sent this case back to the Court of Appeals without addressing these procedural issues that will likely end up barring Tharp from getting any real relief means that the court is pretending it's striking a blow against racial animus while taking an action that will likely provide no benefit in the long run to Tharp. That's Thomas's characterization. And finally, he argued basically that this wasn't the kind of case that was fit for summary disposition. This is the kind of case that deserved full briefing and oral argument if the court was going to decide it. So he makes all those kind of arguments, and again, the majority doesn't really address any of those head on because it was just a short 3-page opinion that doesn't really get into those. So it presents interesting reading. It'd be interesting to know what the members of the majority how they might have responded, but we don't have that here, so we just left to speculate on that. Some more quick comments about this case. There were three justices in the dissent, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch. So it kind of it looks like a 6-3 decision, but in per curiams, it's an odd feature of per curiam opinions is that dissents are not always noted. So a per curiam, for example, may look like a unanimous opinion. It may be issued and there's a per curiam opinion and there are no dissents attached to it. But there may in fact be justices who dissented but didn't feel the need to note their dissent. So it's just kind of an invisible behind the scenes dissent that doesn't show up. That's a strange feature of these per curiam opinions. And the same thing could happen in a divided case like this. It's probably a 6-3 decision, but it's possible it was a 5-4 decision, but one of the dissenters just chose not to write and not to join Justice Thomas's opinion. However, since one of the issues that Justice Thomas raised was that he believed this wasn't fit for summary disposition and should have been argued. We know that there were not four justices who took that position because it only takes four votes to have a case argued rather than decided summarily. If four justices vote to have a case have full briefing and oral argument, then even if the other five justices would be willing to issue a summary decision, the four votes for full argument and briefing trumps that, and the case would have been argued. So we know that there was at most three justices, Thomas Alito and Gorsuch, most likely who would have preferred to have this argued. Things we can speculate about and information we can try and tease out of the opinion. And this is another example, and we saw some of this. Justice Gorsuch was only on the court for the last argument sitting of last term. He was on for the April argument session, which was the last of the term. So he was only involved in about 13 cases at the end of the term. He wrote one majority opinion and then, signed on or wrote a number of other opinions in the other cases. And one thing that was noted by a lot of commentators was his frequent alignment with Justice Thomas. Gorsuch and Thomas were often together on opinions. And Thomas and Alito, before Gorsuch's joining the court, were kind of regarded as the two most conservative justices on the court. And this is another opinion that kind of fits that narrative and shows that Gorsuch, Alito, and Thomas are kind of becoming the new conservative block on the court, with the other conservative justices, the Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy, being the more moderate or centrist or whatever conservative justices. So this is just another data point in that kind of that pattern. And one other, just an interesting, stylistic or feature of this opinion by Justice Thomas is he makes a point very explicitly of naming the murder victim, and he very explicitly faults the majority for not doing so, for talking a lot about the criminal defendant, but giving no recognition to the victim. And this is kind of a running theme for Justice Thomas. He's done this in a number of cases, including in at least one case, he included photographs of the victim in his opinion to try and put a human face on the victim of the crime that was involved. So that's just kind of gives you a little insight in his, his mindset, how he is looking at these types of cases. I'm going to really quickly turn to oral arguments that were heard this week. In last week's live stream, I previewed a bunch of cases. I'm just going to talk real quick about a couple of them. Two of the cases were Fourth Amendment cases about the searches of automobiles. One was Byrd v. United States, and that was about a search without probable cause of a rental car that was driven by an unauthorized driver. Interesting thing in this case was Justice Gorsuch, in the course of this argument, was appeared to be coming down on a pro defendant side, that'd be a more protective against intrusive police searches. But he was proposing a kind of property law based approach to whether there was a sufficient privacy right that the police needed a higher standard of cause before they could search. And that is there's a test in Fourth Amendment law that comes up frequently over and over. It's a long-standing test. It's the reasonable expectation of privacy test, and it's been criticized from a lot of different directions as kind of indeterminate, not very helpful in figuring out when there is or is not a reasonable expectation of privacy. And one approach that's been floated and that Gorsuch kind of name-checked is an approach that looks to property law and other statutory rights that people have, and using those to help define the contours of privacy for Fourth Amendment purposes. And Gorsuch is kind of pushing that again here. And it's an approach that was seen in some of the opinions of his predecessor, Justice Scalia, who wrote some interesting, kind of property law based opinions that looked to concepts like trespass, to determine whether there was a Fourth Amendment violation. And it's also something we've seen from Gorsuch in other cases. Earlier this term, the court heard a case called Carpenter v. United States, which is a case about the police getting cell phone, cell site location data without a warrant. And Gorsuch, in argument in that case, was also pushing a property law-based approach. So that's just an interesting feature to watch. And the other case, Fourth Amendment case, Collins v. Virginia, which was about a warrantless search of a motorcycle that was parked in a residential driveway. We again saw Gorsuch on the more, seemed to be more on the pro-defendant side. And this is, it may surprise some people because of Gorsuch, the portrayal, because for one thing, he has lined up in many cases on the kind of conservative end of the court. And he was portrayed as a kind of arch conservative figure. But it's actually consistent with some of his opinions that he wrote when he was sitting on the Tenth Circuit, where he was actually very receptive to arguments by criminal defendants in the Fourth Amendment context. And in that oral argument, he seemed to be allied with Justice Sotomayor, who is, generally considered one of the most defendant-friendly and kind of furthest to the left justices on the court. But the two of them in this case seemed on the same page. So it's an interesting, although Gorsuch kind of aligns with Thomas and Alito on in many areas, this is an area where they may divide, where Thomas and Alito tend to fall more on the pro-prosecution side in many criminal justice type cases. And Gorsuch may in fact be more defendant-friendly than people may have expected. One other case I'll talk about quickly is Husted v. Randolph Institute, which was argued on Wednesday, just yesterday. And this is a case out of Ohio about Ohio's method of removing registered voters from the voting roll, a method of trying to clean up the voter rolls of voters maybe who have died or moved away. And Ohio's system is based at least in part on the voter's failure to vote for a period of years. This is a case that is very politically contentious. It kind of plays into a Republicans versus Democrats narrative. And a lot of people expected the justices to break along the kind of stereotypical left-right ideological lines, and they still may. It's no way of telling at this point. However, in the argument, Justice Breyer seemed fairly sympathetic to Ohio's position. He seemed concerned that if the court were to strike down this approach that Ohio was taking, it was basically leaving Ohio's hands tied with no realistic way to effectively clean up its voter rolls, and that seemed to concern him and possibly could incline him to side for Ohio. So this could be, you know, potentially not as narrowly divided a case as people were originally expecting. The cases that were heard this week, the audio of those cases will be available starting Friday afternoon. It's the court's practice is to release each week's oral argument audio on early Friday afternoon on the Supreme Court's website. So that's not available yet, but soon we'll be able to actually listen to the arguments. If you're interested, you can listen to them yourselves and hear how they went. So I'm going to now turn for the remainder of today's live stream. I'm going to turn to the cases that are going to be argued next week. Monday's a holiday, so the arguments will only be heard on Tuesday and Wednesday next week, and the court has two cases each day. Unlike this current week, that you know the arguments that just passed, where the court had some kind of days with a like common theme, like Tuesday with the two Fourth Amendment automobile cases. Next week, the four cases are kind of all over the place with no real connection to each other. So I'll just run through each of them and talk a little about what they're about. It's kind of a wide variety of different types of cases. The first case on Tuesday is Hall v. Hall. Now, this is a dispute between two siblings, Elsa and Samuel Hall, over the control of their late mother's estate. The details of their fight are not really important for this case, but the important thing is that there were two separate actions. There was one that was being maintained by Elsa against Samuel, basically alleging he misused some of their mother's property, and the other was by Samuel against Elsa, alleging that she exerted undue influence over her mother before she died. These two cases were consolidated by the court. They were both filed in the same district, and they were consolidated and eventually tried together in a single trial. Now, Elsa lost both cases. She lost in both cases. One of those cases was immediately appealed to the Court of Appeals. The other case, there were various further proceedings in the trial court. Eventually, the jury verdict was vacated. A new trial was ordered. That trial happened. She lost again, and it is still pending in the trial court with some post-trial just proceedings that are still going on down there. So that's still going on. But the other case was done after the first trial, and Elsa immediately tried to appeal it. But the Court of Appeals dismissed her appeal and said that there was no final judgment, so there was no it had no jurisdiction over the case. Now, what this means is in the federal court, there's a rule called the final judgment rule. And what it says is you can't appeal a case to the Court of Appeals unless there's a final judgment, and that's defined as a judgment that disposes of all of the claims for all of the parties. So if a court issues an opinion that dismisses certain claims in a case, but others are still alive and are going forward, that dismissal can't normally be appealed straight up to the Court of Appeals. If the court dismisses a certain defendant from the case or dismisses the claims of certain plaintiffs but not other plaintiffs, again, those can't immediately be appealed up to the Court of Appeals. It has to be all claims by all parties. There is an exception. When something is appealed before there's a final decision, it's known as an interlocutory appeal. And there are some exceptions for certain types of things like injunctions, orders of injunctions and things like that. They're not relevant here. But there is a discretionary process where the district court can explicitly enter a final judgment for less than all the claims or parties to allow certain claims or the claims of certain parties to be immediately appealed up to the Court of Appeals. The general rationale is that interlocutory appeals, that's appeals before everything is all finished, they lead to inefficient piecemeal decisions where the Court of Appeals is only looking at one little piece of a larger puzzle, and it's better to wait till everything's all done and send it all up in one, in one piece. But on the other hand, sometimes that will lead to unnecessary delay and injustice to certain parties if they would have been better served by just immediately getting a decision on their particular issue rather than having to wait for everything to get delayed. So there's this kind of process where the district court can decide if certain cases, certain claims ought to be allowed to go up right away. So the question here is, what happens if two different cases are consolidated? So consolidation is when the court takes two different cases and combines them together for either for limited purposes or for all purposes. And there was a previous unanimous decision of the Supreme Court in 2015. It was called Galboam v. Bank of America. And that involved cases that were combined in something called MDL, which stands for multi-district litigation. And that's when the courts will take cases potentially from district courts all over the country, send them all to one single district court, where they can all be consolidated together under a single judge for certain pretrial purposes. But normally in an MDL, it's only for pretrial purposes. It's for discovery and you know, the case management before trial. But when a case is trial ready, it gets sent back to its original district and tried there. So the cases are not permanently and completely combined. They're only combined for these limited purposes. This very issue came up in the Galboam case involving a case that was in one of these multi-district litigations, and the court held there that in that context, the cases remained distinct and separate. So if claims were dismissed or finally decided in one case that had been brought into a multi-district litigation, that could be immediately appealed, even though there are many other cases that were still ongoing in the multi-district litigation. But here, we're dealing with a case where the cases were consolidated for all purposes. They were consolidated all the way through trial, and a single trial was in fact held on both of the original cases. So the two parties, Elsa Hall, she's the one who lost and is trying to appeal the one of the two, jury verdicts. She argues that the Galboam rule should still apply, that despite being consolidated together, the cases really still are distinct, and she has a final judgment as to one of the two cases, so she should be able to appeal that final judgment. And she points to other purposes, other parts of the federal court process that do treat consolidated cases as if they're still separate, at least for some purposes. For example, settlement, where parties can agree to settle one of several cases that are consolidated without seeking the consent of the parties in the other consolidated cases, which if it was actually one single unified action, they would not be able to do. And that's kind of evidence she points to, things like that, to say that consolidated cases, despite being kind of grouped together for most purposes, are still in reality different separate actions. And she talks about the efficiency concerns about, you know, about piecemeal appeals. And she argues that the Court of Appeals can take a role in policing this, because if one of several consolidated cases is immediately appealed and the Court of Appeals decides that it really ought to be treated together with the other cases, they could stay the appeal, just kind of put it on hold pending lower court proceedings. So that's kind of her argument. And then on the other hand, Samuel Hall, he's the one who won below and is fighting the appeal. he argues that consolidation for all purposes, it really truly does combine the two cases so that the rule in Gelbaum shouldn't apply and this should be treated like a single action. And he also argues that, the big benefit of this is that it allows the district court to do its, to serve its typical role and evaluate when it will allow a interlocutory appeal. That's a partial appeal. Because the trial court is in a situation where it knows the case well and it's been managing the case and has a better grasp on what would be more efficient in the long run. And he also says that basically the Court of Appeals is very poorly suited to do that kind of evaluation because it isn't the one that's been managing the case as it's moved along, you know, toward trial or through trial. And that also the Court of Appeals just has no established system for making that kind of a decision of when to stay cases. So it's kind of opening up a whole new area that the courts of appeals have never had to worry about before. One thing that's interesting here is that both of the parties are arguing for a bright line rule just in opposite directions where one party says that in consolidated cases they should be still considered separate. So they're, you know, a final decision as to one of the consolidated cases can always be appealed, and the other is arguing that they should be treated as one single unified case. There's actually a number of circuits of the circuit courts of appeals that have taken a kind of middle ground, a case-by-case multi-factor analysis where they decide based on various criteria like how much overlap there is in the claims in the different cases, the relationship of the various parties, likelihood of the claims being tried together, and just other considerations of justice and judicial economy to decide whether to allow appeal before all claims of all parties are final. And this kind of a intermediate position, while it seems like a compromise between the two extremes, to some degree it could be the worst of all worlds because it leaves it unclear to the litigants when an appeal has to be taken. If a decision is issued as to one of several consolidated cases, does it need to be appealed because there are time limits on appeals and appeals need to be taken promptly if it actually is final and appealable? And if a deadline for appeal is missed, the right to appeal can be lost completely. What will end up happening is cautious counsel will end up filing a protective appeal, even if they're unsure or think that it may not be appealable. And that just creates unnecessary litigation where the courts of appeal have to decide, well, this was appealed. Was it really something that, you know, should have been appealed or not? So, you know, the both parties are seeking bright line rules and it seems like, you know, likely that the court will go that way as well. One interesting feature about this case is there was an amicus brief. That's a brief filed by non-parties to the case, that was filed by a bunch of retired federal judges. And these retired federal judges, they were stood clearly on the side of, treating the consolidated cases as a merged unified case with no right to appeal, a single case, without the others also being final. And it was basically on pragmatic grounds of district judges being used to this, doing this kind of thing all the time, and knowing the case inside and out, and the Court of Appeals not really being in a good position. So it's just interesting to see these judges who definitely, have a, you know, inside perspective, weighing in. Unclear what the court will do. The Gelbaum case was a unanimous decision setting a bright line rule, you know, respecting a formal distinction between, the consolidated cases. But on the other hand, the retired judges do make a strong case that, you know, judicial efficiency might be better served by treating the consolidated cases as a single case. So interesting to see which way the Supreme Court goes on that. The next case is called Dalmasi v. United States. And it's actually three consolidated cases. The other two are Cox v. United States and Ortiz v. United States. And they concern, military courts. Now this is a bit complicated. There's a lot of acronyms. I'm going to try and break it down and make it as clear as I can. There's several different courts that are at issue here. One of them is called the Court of Military Commission Review, also called the CMCR. Now that court's not directly involved in this case, but it's important for reasons I'll get to in a few minutes. Then there are the Army Court of Criminal Appeals and the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. These are called the CCAs, Courts of Criminal Appeals. And these are courts, military courts that hear appeals from courts martial. And these cases, the three consolidated cases of the Supreme Court, they involve eight separate service members who were convicted in courts martial of various crimes, who then appealed their convictions to one of the CCAs, the Army or Air Force Courts of Appeals. And then the final court is the called the CAAF, which stands for Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. And this is the highest level court of appeals in the military system that sits above the CCAs. And this is the court that these cases were appealed from that court directly to the Supreme Court. And this will also be important in a few minutes. I'll explain why. So the basic here, what's this case all about? The basic idea is that the CCAs, the Courts of Appeals, are staffed by active duty military personnel. Now, there's federal law that dates back to 1870 that disqualifies active duty military personnel from serving in a civil office. It's called the dual office holding ban. And the intention of this was to protect the civilian control of the government by preventing encroachment by military personnel. There was a concern after the Civil War that there might be the ranks of various civil offices in state and federal government filling up with active duty military personnel, and we'd end up having a military government through these military officers serving in civilian government roles. And so this law was passed to prevent that. And it's been amended in various ways over the years. And the current law has various exceptions for certain types of positions. But one of the prohibitions that it does have is it prohibits military personnel from holding an office that requires presidential appointment and Senate confirmation. Okay. So that brings us to the CMCR. That's the Court of Military Commission Review. This was a court created in 2006, and what it does is it hears appeals from the Guantanamo military commissions, and it's kind of an intermediate court between the Guantanamo military commissions and a federal court of appeals that these commissions can be brought to. So the case could be heard in the Guantanamo commission, appealed to the CMCR, and then appealed from there to one of the normal civilian federal courts. Now, there are two ways that someone can be appointed as a judge on the CMCR. One is that the Secretary of Defense can assign an individual to that court who's already a appellate military judge. So the Secretary of Defense can take a current appellate military judge, for example, someone serving on one of the CCAs, and appoint them and assign them to also serve on the CMCR at the same time. Or judges can be appointed, and this could be either civilians or military personnel. They could be appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. Now, several judges on the Army and Air Force CCAs were appointed by President Obama and confirmed by the Senate. And each of the criminal defendants in this case was someone who had their appeal heard by a CCA panel that had at least one judge who was also appointed to the CMCR. And what they're doing is they're challenging their convictions as violating the dual office holding ban, because the court that heard their appeal included an officer who was in violation of that ban. So there's a lot of different kind of issues here. I don't want to get too deep in the weeds, but there's a lot of questions about whether the CMCR actually is a civil office, whether these positions actually require presidential appointment, also whether the question of what's the remedy. Traditionally, in dual office holding situations, upon accepting an incompatible civil office, a military personnel would forfeit their military position, and the criminal defendants here have argued that that should apply in this case. But the government argues that there have been various changes to the law that make that no longer applicable. There's also another, even aside from the dual office holding issue, there's a separate argument that it's kind of a complicated argument that the system of having individuals serving on both the CCAs and the CMCR violates the Constitution's Appointments Clause, which is the clause that specifies how different types of government officials are supposed to be appointed to those offices. That's a little complicated. I'm not going to get into detail on that at this point, but that's another issue that's floating out there. And then there's one final kind of big monkey wrench in this case, and it's this one's pretty interesting, so I'm going to kind of mention it briefly. There was a amicus brief filed by Aditya Bhamsai, who is a law professor at the University of Virginia. And he filed an amicus brief on his own behalf, not representing any other organization or anything. And he basically makes the argument that the Supreme Court has no jurisdiction over appeals from the CAAF. That's the highest court of the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, the higher up court. And that the court can't basically take appeals from that court in the first place. And the basic argument is the Constitution gives the court two different types of jurisdiction. The Supreme Court has what's called original jurisdiction, which means there are certain matters that can be brought directly in the Supreme Court right from the start. But for most types of cases, the court only has appellate jurisdiction, meaning it can hear appeals from lower state or federal courts, but can't hear those types of cases in the first instance by itself. But the argument here is the CAAF, which is housed within the military, is not a real court. It's an executive body exercising executive power in the military, not exercising judicial power. And therefore, an appeal from the CAAF to the Supreme Court is really, in constitutional terms, a brand new action in the Supreme Court, challenging an administrative, determination rather than a true appeal from a court. From a judicial body. And so the argument is the court has no jurisdiction, just can't hear this case in the first place. And this is very interesting because this is not a argument made by either of the parties to the case, but jurisdictional issues where it goes to the court's very power to hear a case are kind of a special thing in the courts because they can be raised at any time. They can't be waived by the parties. Parties can't say, oh, don't worry about that. I'm not concerned. And even the court can even raise them on its own, even if the parties don't raise them, because the court needs to police the boundaries of its own powers and make sure it isn't going further than it's constitutionally allowed to go. So in this case, the court actually granted Professor Bhamsai oral argument time on this issue. So he'll be having 10 minutes in the argument next week to discuss this issue of whether the court has jurisdiction at all. So that's the Tuesday cases. I'm going to run real quickly through the two cases that are going to be heard on Wednesday. The first one's a case called Encino Motorcars v. Navarro, which is a case about the Fair Labor Standards Act, or FLSA, which sets federal overtime pay requirements but carves out exceptions for certain jobs, including some car dealership employees. Now, this case is what's sometimes called a repeater, a Supreme Court repeater. This same case was up at the Supreme Court just two terms ago. And in 2016, the court issued an opinion in this case, basically sending it back down to the lower court for a new decision. I won't get into the details there. But the case has now come back up. And it deals about this very specific question of statutory interpretation. The question is, are service advisors at car dealerships covered by the FLSA? Now, service advisor is a kind of a sales type position that's involved in selling repair and maintenance services to customers. The service advisor doesn't actually perform any maintenance on the car, but they talk to customers and advise them on what services the dealership can provide. Now, there's an exemption in the FLSA for, quote, any salesman, partsman, or mechanic primarily engaged in selling or servicing automobiles. And the argument here is over whether that language encompasses these service advisors. And there's a bunch of different arguments based on kind of careful parsing of the language. And the basic argument from Encino Motorcars, who's arguing that they are exempt, is that they are a salesman, which is one of the service advisors, a salesman. They're selling things to the customers. And they're primarily engaged in servicing automobiles. They work with the service team. And so therefore they fit under both one of the categories of exempt employees and one of the categories of job duties. There are salesmen involved in servicing automobiles, and the other side, Navarro, which is the employee who is seeking overtime pay under the FLSA, argues that's just not the right way to read this, and that basically there's a few arguments, but one is that a better reading of the argument where it says salesmen, partsmen, and mechanics engaged in selling and servicing, the salesman really applies to selling of automobiles, and where the partsmen and mechanics are the ones that apply to servicing of automobiles, and that's a better way of kind of parsing the language of that statute. There's a bunch of other kind of very particular arguments about details of how the language is written, but that's the basic issue there. So it's just a kind of a nitty-gritty, details of how the statute is written and what those words mean in context. And the court's going to have to decide what that really means. So one final case. This is the last case for next Wednesday is a case called McCoy v. Louisiana. And this is a case with some pretty startling facts. It involves a murder prosecution, and the petitioner is the criminal defendant named Robert McCoy. He was charged with a triple murder of his estranged wife's mother, stepfather, and son. And he maintained his innocence, claiming he was out of the state at the time and that he was framed by crooked police involved in some sort of cover-up. Now, he was represented in his trial by an attorney named Larry English. And throughout the pretrial and into the trial, McCoy was pushing English to develop an alibi defense, insisting that he had been out of state and was not involved in this. His attorney, English, became convinced that McCoy was guilty and that the evidence was overwhelming against him. And the attorney ultimately decided that McCoy's best hope was to concede to the killings, admit to it, and seek leniency from the jury due to his diminished mental capacity. Basically, he felt that his client was delusional and out of touch with reality, and that his best chance of not winning the case, but of hopefully saving McCoy's life from a possible death penalty, was to seek leniency on the basis of this mental defects. What ended up happening is at trial, the attorney, English, repeatedly told the jury that McCoy was guilty during the opening statement of the trial, during the closing argument, throughout the course of examining witnesses. He flatly told the jury that his client had actually killed the people. And McCoy, who objected to this before and during the trial, and ended up taking the stand on his own behalf to insist on his innocence, he challenged his conviction, saying that it was ineffective assistance of counsel to concede his guilt at trial against the client's expressed wishes. And here, because McCoy directly, pleaded with the judge to try and get his counsel to not take this tack, there's no dispute that the client definitely did not want him to take this approach. And what this is interesting because it implicates a division between the ultimate objectives of a litigation and strategic decisions. And traditionally, certain key decisions relating to trial belong to the client and the client alone, and the attorney is not allowed to make those without the client's consent. And that includes such things as entering a plea. If he wanted to enter a plea of guilty, an attorney cannot do that without the client agreeing to it. But strategic decisions, tactical decisions of how to conduct a case, how to frame the evidence, and whether to pursue certain arguments instead of other arguments, those type of tactical decisions are supposed to be the province of the lawyer, and actually the client does not necessarily have any right to override the lawyer's judgments on those type of issues. So here McCoy is arguing basically that the choice of conceding guilt is so fundamental in a criminal trial that it should just belong, it just must belong to the client, not the lawyer. And it, even if a conviction is a near certainty, the decision to admit guilt belongs to the defendant. It goes to the core of the right to representation. Basically, the argument is that the Sixth Amendment's right to be represented by counsel becomes kind of meaningless if the lawyer can override the client on such a fundamental matter. That's the basic argument on McCoy's side. The other side, represented by the state of Louisiana, it really focuses in on the strategic side of things. And they say basically crimes, a given criminal crime has a number of elements. Those are the specific facts that need to be proved in order to convict somebody of that crime. And it's perfectly acceptable for an attorney to concede certain elements of the crime if they want to focus and fight on other elements of the crime as a strategic decision. You might, for example, if it was a fraud case, where it's alleged that somebody made untrue statements with the intent to deceive someone else, you might concede that certain statements were made and that they're untrue. Maybe that's undeniable because there's, you know, clear documentary evidence of statements that were made. But fight on the intent part, that there was any intent to deceive anyone. That would be a reasonable strategic decision. Louisiana argues that's exactly what the counsel did here. They conceded guilt at trial. They didn't plead guilty. They conceded guilt on the fact of killing those three people, but still fought on his mental state, which is part of the elements of the crime. Now, McCoy argues back that if that's the case, he did an incompetent job even of that because he didn't effectively argue in a legally valid way a defense against the mental elements of the crime. And really the two, if you read the briefs of, the two parties, they paint starkly different pictures of McCoy, English, the attorney's behavior. McCoy's brief basically paints him as completely incompetent and lacking in diligence in doing the work he should have, even if his decision to, concede guilt was a reasonable one. On the other hand, Louisiana really is trying to paint a picture of a lawyer who is placed in a really tough position with a delusional client who's insisting on putting on a frivolous defense that's going to lead him straight to the death penalty. So it's interesting to see where the court will go on that one.
And that brings us to the end of episode 19. As of this recording, the next scheduled live stream will be on Thursday, January 18th at 9 p.m. Eastern. We're trying to broadcast these on a regular weekly basis, and at least for now, we'll be live on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Please check the Counting to Five YouTube channel to find the next scheduled live stream. If you join us during the broadcast, you can ask your own questions in the live chat, and I'll do my best to answer them on the air. Links to resources related to this episode can be found in the show notes at countingto5.com. That's T-O and the number 5. You can leave comments and questions on the show notes post at countingto5.com, on the Counting to Five Facebook page or YouTube channel, tweet at Counting to Five, or send an email to mike@countingto5.com. You can call and leave questions and comments on the Counting to Five voicemail line at 774-226-8685. That's 774-2-COUNT-5. Your feedback helps us bring the content you want to hear. If you aren't already subscribing to Counting to Five, please subscribe now at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you find podcasts. If Counting to Five isn't available in your podcast app, service, or directory, please let us know and we'll do what we can to get it listed. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to Five.